Nicholson pushed the patrol fairly hard all day, but by nightfall, they still hadn't caught up to the Apaches, or even caught sight of the war party's dust. The kid spotted something interesting as gloom began to settle over the landscape. A scattering of lights winked in the distance. He pointed out the glowing yellow pinpricks to Nicholson, who raised a hand to stop the patrol.
Is that the Apache camp?
Looks more like a town to me. I'd say it's probably one of those border settlements we talked about earlier.
Then that's where we need to go. The people there can tell us how far it is to the border.
That settled the question of where the patrol would camp for the night, which was good. So far, the kid hadn't seen a really suitable place. Nicholson waved the troops forward. As they drew closer, it became easier to see that the lights came through windows in a number of buildings. The settlement wasn't very big, with a main street running north and south that stretched for a couple of blocks. Some dwellings were scattered here and there. Even in the gloom, the kid could tell that all of them were constructed of adobe, and most were squat and square. One place in the first block had two stories, making it the biggest structure in town. A sign on the building read, Sago Hotel and Saloon.
Sago? You think that's the name of this settlement?
Either that or the name of the man who owns the place. Maybe even both. There's an easy way to find out.
Of course. Go inside and ask someone.
Nicholson turned in the saddle.
Sergeant Brennan, you and the men wait out here. You can dismount and allow the horses to drink at that water trough.
Nicholson pointed to a well that was situated in the middle of the intersection where the settlement's lone cross street bisected the main street. A windmill, an elevated water tank, and a long trough that could be filled from a spout attached to the tank were nearby. The setup reminded the kid of water stops he had seen along the railroads. That was an odd place to put a well. Right in the middle of town like that, the kid mused. Then he realized the well had probably been there first, and the settlement had grown up around it. Water was so precious in the mostly dry region that such a thing was completely understandable. He and the lieutenant dismounted and looped their reins around a hitch rack in front of the hotel and saloon. The kid and Nicholson stepped onto the building's low porch. Instead of the bat wings found on most saloon entrances, this one had a pair of regular doors. Nicholson took the lead and opened one of them, striding in with the kid behind him. With his hand held close to the butt of his Colt, the kid moved into the room behind Nicholson and looked around. The long bar was in an L shape, starting on the right side of the room and running across the rear wall, ending where a staircase ascended to the second floor balcony. Tables filled the middle of the room, and along the left-hand wall was a gambling layout, including tables for poker, faro, keno, and blackjack, along with a roulette wheel. No one was trying their luck at the moment. In fact, the saloon wasn't very busy. Only two tables were occupied, and maybe a dozen men stood at the bar, nursing drinks and mugs of beer. One white-aproned bartender was enough to tend to their needs. The only woman in the place was a faded blonde who wore a frilly dress and had an empty tray in her hand as she stood in the angle of the bar. The kid figured she had just delivered drinks to one of the tables. The men at the bar were a mixture of American cowboys and Mexican vaqueros. Three more vaqueros sat at one of the tables. All seemed to be getting along. The four men sitting at the other occupied table didn't look like the sort to be chasing cows. One of them was big and rugged, with a shock of coarse red hair under a thumbed back Stetson. To his left was a man with a pale, narrow face and deep-set dark eyes. Across from the redhead, with his back to the kid so that his face wasn't visible, sat a man in a charro jacket and wide-brimmed felt sombrero with a colorfully woven band, but no other decoration. The fourth man, on the redhead's right, was an Indian, but not an Apache. He wore high-topped moccasins, buckskin trousers, and a loose homespun shirt with a blue sash tied around his waist. A blue headband held back his shoulder-length black hair. The kid would have been willing to bet the man was a Yaqui. He had met some of them over in Texas, in a place called Rattlesnake Valley. He took all that in with a glance as he followed Nicholson to the bar. The apron came along the hardwood and gave them a friendly nod. He was in his 40s, thick-bodied, with gray hair and the flushed face of a man who consumed too much of his own product.
What can I do for you, Captain?
It's Lieutenant. What's the name of this settlement?
This is Sago, New Mexico Territory, Lieutenant. Named after me, Edwin Sago. I dug that well and founded the town.
Can you tell us how far it is from here to the Mexican border?
Did you see the well when you rode into town?
Of course. It would be difficult to overlook.
Well then, you've seen the border. That's it right there. Happenstance, mind you. I didn't set out to drill the well right on the line, but that's where I found water.
You mean the town sits directly on the border?
That's right. The south side of town is in Mexico. Of course, on a practical level, it doesn't really matter much. Folks go back and forth all the time. Nobody really cares which side of the line they're on.
I do. My authority stops at the border.
Your authority to do what, Lieutenant? If you don't mind me asking.
We're in pursuit of a band of hostiles. Apaches.
And they have four prisoners with them. White women.
The kid watched the four men at the table from the corner of his eye as he said that. The tough-looking redhead's eyes narrowed slightly as he leaned forward a couple of inches in an instinctive reaction. The other three men cut their eyes at him, even the stocky Mexican, who turned his head enough to look toward the bar.
Now that's a real shame. I feel sorry for those ladies. We'd heard some rumors around here about a bunch of Bronco Apaches coming over the border, but nobody in town has seen hide nor hair of them. Thank the Lord for that, I say.
How can you be sure no one has seen them?
Because everybody in this part of the territory comes in here sooner or later, Lieutenant, and I keep my eyes and ears open. This is the only real watering hole in these parts, and I'm talking about the well and the saloon.
The war party's tracks lead in this direction. They must have slipped around the town in the dark. We can't be that far behind them.
We can probably pick up their trail in the morning and catch up to them before the day's over.
Who might you be, mister?
Name's Morgan. I'm working as a civilian scout for the lieutenant here.
And you know perfectly well that our pursuit of the hostiles is over, Mr. Morgan. I told you before, my authority ends at the border. I'll not be a party to an illegal incursion into a sovereign foreign nation.
We can talk about this later.
There's nothing to talk about. It's over. We'll be camping nearby tonight, Mr. Sago.
I've got several empty rooms upstairs. That's the hotel part of the business. You and Mr. Morgan are welcome to stay here, Lieutenant. No charge for the cavalry.
No, thank you. I'll stay with my men. Come on, Morgan.
I thought I might stay here and have a beer. Maybe something to eat.
Have you forgotten what occurred earlier?
No, I gave you my word, and I intend to keep it.
Very well. I'll hold you to that. I have to go make sure none of my men have strayed past the well into Mexico.
You said you wanted a beer?
That's right. Do you have any food?
Tortillas, beans, and beef.
That sounds just fine.
Sago drew the beer and slid the mug across the hardwood to the kid.
What was that the lieutenant said about something happened earlier?
Nothing for you to worry about. Just a disagreement over tactics.
I didn't think officers had disagreements about tactics with civilians.
Neither did the lieutenant.
Sit down wherever you want. I'll have Greta bring a plate of food to you.
Much obliged.
The kid dropped a $5 gold piece on the bar.
That buys you the hospitality of the house, Mr. Morgan. Which includes Greta, if you want.
I'll think about it.
He carried the beer over to one of the tables and sat down. He was aware that the four men were still watching him without being too obvious about it. Conversations among the cowboys and vaqueros had quieted while Nicholson and the kid were talking to Sago, but it started up again, most likely about the potential threat of an Apache war party in the area. Sago had said that there were rumors about that, but the arrival of the cavalry had confirmed the possible menace. Of course, now that the Apaches were across the border in Mexico, it was doubtful they would double back to attack the town or any of the ranches in the area. More than likely, the raiders had done all the damage they intended to do and just wanted to get back to their stronghold somewhere in the fastness of the Mexican mountains. The blonde had gone behind the bar and disappeared. She emerged from a door carrying a couple of plates on her tray and crossed to the kid's table.
Here you are, sir.
She then set the plates on the table in front of him. One held a stack of tortillas, the other piles of beans and beef. Up close, the kid saw that the woman looked wearier than he'd thought. She was somewhere around 30, old for working in a saloon. Tiny lines around her eyes and mouth indicated she had lived a hard life, but her blue eyes were clear and beautiful. The kid smiled up at her and slipped her another gold piece.
Your name is Greta?
That's right.
Thank you, Greta. I appreciate it.
She hesitated, holding the empty tray in front of her.
Mr. Sago said that if you stay here and you want some company later on...
There's nobody I'd like to get to know better, but I've been riding with that stuffed shirt lieutenant all day. And to tell you the truth, it's just flat worn me out.
I understand. Enjoy your meal.
I intend to.
She turned and started back toward the bar. Looking up from his food, the kid saw that the Mexican sitting at the table with the other three men had hold of Greta's wrist and was trying to pull her onto his lap. His other hand roughly caressed her hip.
Oh, hell.
Greta continued trying to pull loose from the Mexican's grip as the kid pushed his chair back and stood up. At the bar, Edwin Sago frowned worriedly. Some of the cowboys and vaqueros began to sidle toward the door, obviously intent on getting out of there before any real trouble started.
Oh, what's the matter, Chiquita? You are quick to make the other man happy, but you're not willing to bring a smile to the face of Guadalupe Valdez.
I just...
You just don't like stinking greasers, is that it?
You said it, mister, not her.
Valdez's head jerked toward the kid.
Let her go.
As he did, Valdez came to his feet.
I don't like anybody telling me what to do, senor.
The kid got a good look at him for the first time. Valdez's face was dark and brutal, and broad like his body. He sported a thick black mustache and heavy beard stubble.
You must run into a lot of trouble if you're always as much of a jackass as you're being now.
Listen, gents, I don't want any trouble here.
No trouble, senor. It will be no trouble at all.
His right hand flashed across his body and plucked a knife from a sheath on his left hip.
For me to carve my name in this damn gringo's hide!
He charged at the kid like a maddened bull. The kid stayed put, and as soon as Valdez was within reach, he brought his right foot up in a blindingly swift kick that sank the toe of his boot in the Mexican's groin. Valdez dropped the knife as he collapsed onto the floor. The kid heard a person stand to his right. The pale-faced man next to the redhead was coming up and reaching for his gun. He was fast, but the kid knew he could beat the man's draw. But he didn't have to. The redhead moved fast and swept a leg around, knocking his companion's legs out from under him.
Oh, stupid chess.
The redhead held out a hand toward the kid, as if asking him not to kill the man on the floor.
You saw what happened. Lupe brought this trouble on himself.
The man called chess glared. His eyes flicked toward the revolver that lay a couple of feet from him, and for a second, the kid thought he was going to make a grab for it.
You're right, Kelly. Now, all right, mister. I'm gonna pick up my gun and put it back in my holster. Don't get antsy.
I don't get antsy.
All through the confrontation, the Yaqui hadn't moved, except for his eyes. They had taken in everything, and the kid would have bet that if the Yaqui had needed to do anything, it would have gotten done in a hurry. Chess reached for his gun.
Why don't you use your left hand? Just so nobody gets any ideas.
Chess glared some more, but he reached over with his left hand to pick up the gun. He set it on the table, then grasped the edge and pulled himself to his feet. The redhead, Kelly, Chess had called him, smiled at the kid.
Sorry about the trouble. Lupe sometimes forgets he's supposed to be civilized now. He comes from so far back in the mountains, he's not much more than an animal.
Then I don't suppose it would do any good to tell him to apologize to the lady.
Oh, not a bit, but I'll do it on his behalf.
Kelly took his hat off. He looked at Greta, who stood nearby looking frightened.
I'm sorry for my amigo's behavior, ma'am. I hope he didn't hurt you too much.
Greta lifted her hand and looked at her wrist, then rubbed it against the back of the other hand holding the tray.
No, I'm fine. He just took me by surprise more than anything else.
Lupe is a surprising sort. You forgive us then?
Of course.
Greta, come on back over here.
She went, casting a glance at the kid as she did so. He saw gratitude in her blue eyes, but also worry.
I reckon you could have killed Lupe if he'd wanted to. I appreciate you just busting him in the balls instead. Although right about now, if you asked him, he might tell you he'd rather be dead.
For the first time, the Yaqui showed some reaction.
That one will walk funny for a week.
Yeah.
Kelly gestured toward one of the empty chairs at the table.
Care to sit down and have a drink with us, Mr. Morgan, was it?
That's right. Is it all right if I bring my supper with me?
Sure.
The kid fetched the plates from the other table and pulled out a chair at Kelly's table.
Chess, why don't you help Lupe into a chair at one of the other tables?
Kelly tossed a coin to Chess, who had pouched his iron, but still stood tensely beside the table.
Buy him a bottle of mezcal. That'll take his mind off his troubles.
Sure, Kelly.
Chess bent down. With a show of surprising strength, considering his slight frame, he hauled Valdez to his feet. With Chess supporting him, the Mexican waddled over to an empty table and sat down.
Sago, we need another bottle and glass over here.
I'll bring it myself.
Sago brought over the whiskey and a clean glass and took away the empty bottle that sat in the middle of the table. Kelly picked up the new bottle, pulled the cork from it, and splashed amber liquid into his glass and the kid's.
Your friend's not drinking?
Mateo's an Indian, as I'm sure you can tell. He has a problem handling liquor. You wouldn't want to be around him after he's had a drink. I wouldn't want to. And he and I have been amigos for a long time. I'm Enrique Kelly, by the way. Here's to your continued health, Mr. Morgan.
He lifted his glass and tossed back the fiery liquor.
You're probably wondering about that name.
The kid wasn't, but he didn't say anything, figuring Kelly was going to tell him anyway. He busied himself with the tortillas, beans, and beef.
My father, God rest his soul, was an Irishman. The Irish love for drinking, fighting, and wandering. He was an adventurer, a soldier of fortune, a filibuster. He wound up working for Maximilian, and that's what he was doing when he met my mother, a beautiful Mexican señorita. A high-born lady, you understand, from a family who didn't want her marrying from some ragtag Irish mercenary. They wound up running away together, getting hitched by some village priest in the mountains, and you see the result of that union sitting here before you. Quite a romantic tale, isn't it?
Worthy of a cheap novel.
We'll take that comment in a friendly spirit in which it was meant.
He poured another drink, even though it was obvious he'd had plenty before the kid and Lieutenant Nicholson arrived in town.
So, you're a scout for the cavalry, are you?
For the moment.
What's this about an Apache war party? We've heard rumors, but I'd like some cold, hard facts.
I don't know all that much firsthand. According to the lieutenant, 100 Apache warriors crossed the border from Mexico about a week and a half ago and started raiding north of here. They hit some ranches and are even supposed to have attacked a town. I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know they wiped out a wagon train in a valley about 30 miles north of here. I saw with my own eyes what happened to those poor people.
A wagon train? I didn't know there were such things anymore.
There are a few.
And you said something about prisoners.
4 women.
You know this for a fact.
When I came along and found out what had happened, one of the men with the wagon train was still alive. Before he died, he told me he had seen the prisoners being taken away.
A dying statement. You have to believe that.
I knew the man who made it. I believe him.
Well, it's a right shame for those poor women. They'll be treated roughly. Probably already have been.
Probably.
And there'll be no help for them, since the lieutenant made it clear he won't pursue the Apaches into Mexico.
Maybe they'll run across some rurales.
If the rurales see any Apaches, they'll be the ones doing the running, amigo. Running the other way as fast as they can. Oh, you can depend on that. They want no trouble with the Apaches. They only hunt down bandits in the hopes of liberating some loot for themselves.
Thanks for the drink.
Sure you don't want another?
I'm sure.
He looked over at the other table, where Guadalupe Valdez sat hunched over, sucking greedily at a bottle of mezcal. The Mexican slanted his eyes toward the kid, and they were full of pure hatred. He could get in a long line of men who hated Kid Morgan. Without looking back, the kid headed for the door. He hoped Lieutenant Nicholson hadn't had the dun taken away with the other horses. If the horse was still tied up at the hitch rack in front of the saloon, the kid intended to mount up and head for the border. He stepped onto the low porch in front of the saloon. The dun was still there, with the reins looped around the hitch rack. The kid smiled, stepped off the porch, and reached for those reins.
Hold it.
The kid stayed where he was for a second, then slowly lowered his hand away from the reins.
The lieutenant sent me to make sure you keep your parole. Seems he got a mite worried you wouldn't keep your word. Thought you might try to get across the border and go after those hostiles.
I gave him my word I wouldn't use my gun against him or any of you troopers.
Yeah, I know. You thought you could slicker us that way, didn't you? Well, it's not gonna work. You're still under arrest, Morgan. Untie your horse and come with me.
The kid hesitated. Brennan's rifle was ready, but even so, the kid knew he might be able to draw and fire before the non-com could get off a shot. But that would mean breaking his word.
Where's the camp?
Just north of town. Come on, quit stalling.
All right.
The kid untied the dun's reins and led the horse along the street. Brennan followed, and the fact that a man who hated him was behind him with a gun made the skin on the back of the kid's neck crawl. Despite that, he didn't think Brennan would shoot him down in the middle of the street. He saw that they were coming to a darkened alley between 2 buildings.
Wait a minute. Go through there. It's a shortcut.
Thought you said the camp was north of town.
It is. Northeast. Go on, do like I told you.
The kid knew what would happen if he started down that dark alley. Brennan intended to shoot him in the back, then claim that he'd tried to escape. Lieutenant Nicholson might be suspicious, but he wouldn't be able to prove that Brennan wasn't telling the truth.
Mr. Morgan?
Brennan's head jerked around toward the newcomer. The kid took advantage of the unexpected opportunity and dropped the reins. He lunged at Brennan. He grabbed the rifle barrel and wrenched it skyward. Brennan tightened his grip on the weapon, trying to ram the stock into the kid's face. The kid had his other hand on the rifle's breech and stopped the blow. The two men staggered to the side as they wrestled over the Springfield. Brennan stuck a foot between the kid's ankles to trip him. Brennan fell with him and they rolled over and over. Thinking he had an opportunity, Brennan pulled the trigger of the Springfield. Both men froze for a second, but the kid recovered first. He ripped the rifle out of Brennan's hands and slashed out with the butt. The kid felt bone crunch under the impact, and a surge of savage satisfaction went through him. But that satisfaction was tempered by worry. He had recognized the voice that called his name. It belonged to Greta, the blonde saloon girl from Sago's place. Brennan seemed to be stunned, so the kid tossed the empty rifle aside and leaped to his feet. He spotted the crumpled form lying a few yards away next to one of the buildings. Hurrying to her, he dropped to a knee beside her and leaned over to see if she was still alive.
Are you hit?
He got an arm under Greta's shoulders and lifted her head.
I'm not sure. I think so. My side.
The kid put a hand on her right side and found nothing. But when he moved it to the left, he felt the wet heat of blood soaking through her dress.
Is there a doctor here in town?
No. But if you take me to my house, I have a friend who can take care of me.
You don't live at the saloon?
No. I have a place on the south side of the settlement.
Across the border, the kid thought, as he glanced at the well that marked the boundary. Sago had said people around there didn't pay much attention to it, so the kid wasn't surprised that Greta lived over the line. No one had come to investigate the shot. He supposed such sounds weren't that uncommon around there. If anybody was going to help Greta, it looked like it would have to be him. Moving carefully, he slid his other arm under her knees, then straightened to his feet, lifting her and cradling her against him. She hadn't looked particularly thin in the saloon, but there was a certain fragility to her as he held her in his arms, almost an insubstantialness as if she were fading away. He clucked to the dun to indicate the horse should follow him, then started walking toward the border.
You'll have to tell me how to get to your place.
Greta gave him a weak nod and put her arms around his neck to help support herself.
It's on the edge of the settlement, to the southwest.
He looked back once and saw Brennan struggling to his feet. Once they reached Greta's home, the kid awkwardly worked the latch on the front door and carried her inside. She told him the bed was to the left. In the dark, he found it and lowered her onto the thin mattress. Then he stepped back and, still following her directions, found an oil lamp and scratched a lucifer from his pocket into life to light it. The flickering yellow glow of the lamp expanded and filled the cottage's single room. It was sparsely furnished, the bed, a table, a couple of chairs, an old wooden trunk, and a battered and scarred wardrobe. The floor was dirt, and some shelves on one wall held a few supplies.
I'd better take a look at that wound and see how bad you're hurt.
He leaned over her. The bloodstain on her dress was about a foot in diameter, but it didn't seem to be spreading.
No, I'll be all right. Find Consuela next door. She'll help me. You need to go after those Apaches. That's what you were about to do, isn't it?
I'm not going anywhere until I'm sure that you're all right. Except to fetch this Consuela.
His long-legged strides took him to another small adobe jacal next to Greta's place. A worried-looking Mexican man opened the door.
I need to see Consuela. Greta is hurt and asked for her.
The man's eyes widened in the light of the candle he held. He turned his head and spoke in rapid Spanish. The kid was able to follow enough of it to know that Consuela was the man's wife, and he didn't want her going anywhere with the strange gringo. Consuela appeared and pushed past her husband with little difficulty.
Where is she? At her house?
The kid nodded and waved a hand in that direction. Consuela, who wore a nightdress with a shawl wrapped around her shoulders, hurried toward Greta's place. The kid and Consuela's husband followed. Consuela, who had already disappeared into Greta's cottage, met them at the door.
Hector, go get Señor Sego.
Hector looked like he wanted to argue, but after a second, he nodded. He hurried off to the American side of the settlement. The kid waited. He thought about Greta, sensing that she had a certain shyness about her, despite the fact that she worked in a saloon and sold herself to men. In other surroundings, though, she wasn't that way. He was more than willing to honor that and not intrude. A few minutes later, Edwin Sago hurried across the border toward the house.
Greta, is she all right?
I don't know. I don't think she's hurt too bad, but I'm not sure about that.
What the hell happened? I heard a shot outside a little while after you left, but I didn't think anything about it. Some drunken cowboy or vaquero is always letting off steam around here by firing a gun into the air.
It was the sergeant from that cavalry patrol. He was trying to kill me because of a run-in we had before.
So you've got the cavalry after you now?
Maybe, but I'm on the other side of the border.
The kid tensed. He caught sight of four men riding south along the street, past the well and into Mexico. They galloped past Greta's cottage, never slowing down. The kid recognized them in the moonlight. Enrique Kelly and his three friends. They were on their way somewhere in a hurry.
What do you know about those men, Sago?
Not a blasted thing except their names. They only rode in today. I'd never seen them before that. Tough-looking bunch, though.
Bet they are.
A step in the doorway made him swing around sharply.
The bullet just grazed poor Greta in the side. She bled enough to make her sick and weak, but the bleeding is stopped now and I cleaned the wound. I will make a poultice to draw out any poison and she will be fine.
Thank you, Consuela. Whatever Greta needs, you know I'll pay for it.
She should not need much, only care. You wish to see her?
I do.
He really seems to care about her.
He does. Why would he not? He is in love with her.
But she works in his saloon. She,
goes with men. Love is different for everyone, Senor Morgan.
I suppose you're right.
The kid turned to look toward the center of town as hoofbeats rumbled in the night. He saw a dark mass of riders in the street. They came to a stop on the other side of the well. One of the horsemen separated himself from the others and rode forward slowly, halting when he came even with the water trough.
Morgan! Morgan, I see you down there!
You better go back inside and keep Sago there. Hector, take your kids and go home.
Senor!
It'll be all right. Tell Greta I wish her the best.
And for you as well, Senor.
Morgan!
The kid hooked his thumbs in his belt and walked out a few feet from the house.
What do you want, Lieutenant?
You gave me your word.
And I kept it. I didn't use my gun against you or any of your men.
You broke Sergeant Brennan's jaw.
Yeah, but I used his rifle to do it.
And you've illegally crossed the border into Mexico.
I never promised I wouldn't do that.
Morgan, I'm calling on you to come back across the line and surrender. If you don't, you can consider yourself a fugitive from the United States Army.
Sorry, Lieutenant. I'm going after those Apaches. I've got some captives to rescue.
You're insane!
This isn't the first time I've been accused of that.
You know I'm prohibited from crossing the border to pursue you.
The kid reached for the Dunn's reins.
So long, Lieutenant!
But I think I can stretch a point and allow my men to fire across the border.
The kid's eyes widened in surprise. He lunged for the Dunn and grabbed the horse's reins as Nicholson bellowed the order to open fire. The kid hadn't expected that. He was pretty sure if it was against Army regulations for Nicholson to cross the border, shooting over the line was probably prohibited too. Luckily, accurate shooting was almost impossible in the dark. The settlement of Sago rapidly fell behind him. He was confident Nicholson wouldn't come after him. That was one less thing he had to worry about. All he had to figure out was how one man was going to take four prisoners away from 100 bloodthirsty Apaches without getting killed in the process. The kid rode for a couple of miles, steering southward by the stars, before he stopped. He didn't want to go too far in case he had to backtrack to pick up the trail of the Apaches. Looking back, he could still see the lights of Sago in the distance. He thought about Greta and hoped she would be all right. She seemed to have a good friend in Consuela, and according to the Mexican woman, Edwin Sago loved her and would help care for her, so she probably stood a good chance of pulling through. He couldn't find it in him to regret doing that. The sergeant had been asking for it. The kid looked around until he found a little hollow ringed by mesquite bushes. That would do for a camp. Since he had eaten back in the settlement, he didn't have to worry about a fire, just a place to spread his bedroll. In the desert latitudes, the night air cooled quickly. By morning, when the kid rolled out of his blankets, it was downright chilly. The sun wasn't up, but the eastern sky was gray and the stars were fading overhead. He looked toward Sago, where a few lights glowed in the homes of early risers. He supposed Lieutenant Nicholson and the rest of the patrol would start back to Fort Bliss. Hunkered on his heels, the kid built a small fire out of mesquite branches and boiled some coffee. He had some supplies from the wagon train left, although the biscuits were getting a little stale. Together with the salt pork, they made a decent meal. When he had finished eating and cleaned up after himself, he saddled the dun and led it out of the mesquites. The sun still wasn't up, but the brilliant orange glow on the eastern horizon told him it soon would be. There was enough light to see by, so he swung up into the saddle. The Apaches hadn't paraded right through Sago with their captives, so they had to have gone either east or west of the settlement. The kid rode back toward the border, angling toward the east. He spent more than an hour riding back and forth before he finally came across the tracks of the war party about a mile west of the settlement. The sun was up, and the day was growing hot as he turned to follow the tracks to the south. The kid rode another hour before he reined in sharply and lifted his head. Three shots, spaced close together like that, were undoubtedly meant to be a signal. The fact that no more shots followed was a good indication of that, too. The kid frowned. It was unlikely the Apaches were signaling to each other. Judging from the tracks he'd been following, they were all sticking together. He thought about Enrique Kelly, Chess, Valdez, and Mateo. They had ridden out of the border town the night before, heading in the same general direction. A signal like that usually meant a search of some sort. Had Kelly and the others been looking for something? The trail of the Apache war party, maybe? The shots probably meant they had found it. The kid pressed on. If Kelly and the other men were ahead of him, he would deal with that when and if it became a problem. For now, his attention was still focused on following the trail. Since he had started trailing the war party, he had worried that he would come across the mutilated body of at least one of the women. If the Apaches tired of their captives, it was entirely possible that they would just cut the women's throats and leave them behind for the buzzards. For that reason, the kid kept glancing at the sky, fearful he would see the carrion eater circling. So far, that hadn't happened, but the kid wondered how long the prisoner's luck would hold. The kid could see mountains ahead and to the west of him, but the trail led through country that could only be described as desert. He saw a few snakes, lizards, and giant hairy-legged tarantulas, but those were the only signs of life. By midday, his shirt was sodden with sweat, and he had started looking for a place that offered a little shade where he and the dun could wait out the hottest part of the day. He found it in a small arroyo. A mesquite grew on the edge of it, and the space underneath the tree had been hollowed out by the very occasional flash floods that ran through there. Despite the kid's intention to stay awake, in the heat, it was almost impossible not to doze off. With his back against the wall of the arroyo and his hat tilted forward over his eyes, he drifted into slumber. Sometime later, he wasn't sure exactly how long, although the sun was still up, he was awakened by what sounded like a gun battle. Again, he thought about Kelly and the other men who had ridden out of Sega. If they were looking for trouble, they must have found it. The kid got to his feet, untied the dun's reins from the mesquite roots that protruded from the arroyo wall, and mounted up. In the big empty landscape, it was going to be hard to sneak up on anybody. Suddenly, after another mile or so, the ground almost fell out from under him with no warning.
Whoa, whoa!
He reined in and stared at the deep canyon that slashed across the barren earth in front of him. The canyon was 50 or 60 feet wide and at least 100 feet deep. It stretched as far as the kid could see in both directions. The walls were perpendicular to the floor of the canyon, or close enough to it. Only a fly could climb up and down them. Except where the Apache trail led, a narrow ledge zigzagged its way to the bottom, then up to the other side. The ledge was wide enough for one man on horseback, maybe two, if the riders were brave or foolhardy enough. The kid couldn't tell at first glance if it was natural. Something about it struck him as man-made, as if someone had carved the ledge into the rocky walls. It might be the only place for miles where a man could cross the canyon without having to ride around it for a day or more. The Apaches must have known about it. They had ridden straight to this spot, even though the kid didn't see any landmarks nearby that could have guided them. He dismounted and left the dun with reins dangling, knowing the horse was unlikely to bolt. He pulled the Winchester from its sheath and levered around into the chamber. Carrying the rifle, The kid moved forward cautiously until he could peer down into the great declivity. Puffs of gun smoke told him where the shots were coming from. The ledge on both sides was littered with slabs of rock that had sheared away from the canyon walls in ages past and toppled onto the trail, creating obstacles, but also places where men under fire could take cover. That was obviously what had happened. About halfway down on either side of the canyon, two groups of riflemen crouched behind those rocks and took potshots at each other. The group on the opposite side was slightly higher than the men on the side where the kid was, giving them a small advantage. Their numbers were also greater. Shots were coming from eight different places over there. And when the kid bellied down and risked a look over the rim on his side, he saw only four men under attack. 2-1 odds. The men on his side of the canyon weren't strangers. From up there, he could see behind the rocks where they were crouched. He recognized Enrique Kelly, Lupe Valdez, the man called Chess, and the Yaqui, Mateo. Except for brief glimpses, the rocks on the opposite ledge concealed the riflemen over there. The kid caught sight of leggings, blue and red shirts, and equally colorful headbands and sashes. Apaches. No doubt about it. The kid edged the Winchester's barrel over the rim rock. He nestled his cheek against the smooth wood of the stock, peered over the barrel, and lined the sights on a slab of rock where he had seen one of the Apaches poke his head up for a second a few moments earlier. The Apache who had unwisely lifted his head flew backward as the kid's steel-jacketed slug bored through his skull and exploded out again in a pink, grisly shower of blood, brain matter, and bone fragments. The dead warrior's body hadn't hit the ground by the time the kid shifted his aim and honed in on another rock. The Apache, kneeling behind it, evidently startled by his companion's sudden death, twisted around to look at the bloody corpse. That Apache went down and lay still. In a matter of seconds, the odds had improved considerably. By now, the remaining Apaches realized they were under attack from above. They lifted their rifles and started peppering the rim rock with slugs. The kid rolled away from the edge. He lay there for several moments, using the opportunity to thumb fresh cartridges through the Winchester's loading gate. When the rifle's magazine was full again, he tossed his hat aside and crawled toward the rim again. The Apaches seemed to have gone back to shooting at Kelly and the others. They had left one man watching for him. Tiny bits of gravel stung his cheek. The kid forced himself not to flinch and pulled the trigger. An instant later, he saw his attacker fall lifeless to the ground. Now that the kid had personally accounted for almost half of the ambushers, the pendulum had swung the other way. He pulled back a little and watched as Kelly and his friends picked off the other Indians, one by one. Enrique Kelly was the first to break the silence.
Oi! Whoever's up there on the rim, you sure as hell saved our bacon, mister.
The kid moved forward so he could look down at them. The men had emerged from their cover behind the rocks, but Chess and Mateo still had their rifles trained on the opposite wall, just in case any of the Apaches were clinging to life and tried to resume the fight. Kelly and Valdez peered up at the rim, each man using a hand to shield his eyes.
It's him! Morgan! The bastard who kicked me in the cojones!
Valdez jerked his Winchester to his shoulder. Before Valdez could fire, Kelly's hand shot out, grabbed the rifle's barrel, and forced it down.
Quit it, you fool. Morgan probably saved our lives just now.
Kelly pulled the rifle out of Valdez's hands.
Morgan, come on down.
The kid's instincts told him not to trust these men. But if he was going to convince them to help him free those captives, he had to make them think that he did. He waved his rifle over his head.
I'll get my horse!
He picked up his hat, slid the Winchester back in the saddle boot, and took the Dunn's reins. It would be easier and probably safer to lead the horse down the ledge than to ride. As he started down, he saw that the others had already resumed their descent rather than waiting for him. By the time he reached the bottom of the canyon, Valdez and Mateo had gone over to the bodies of the Apaches who had fallen off the ledge. Making sure the warriors were dead, the kid thought, even though it was highly unlikely any of them had survived the fall on top of being shot. Kelly and Chess stood waiting with the horses near the base of the trail.
When somebody started shooting from the rimrock, I had a hunch it was you, Morgan. I knew you weren't going to pay any attention to that stiff-necked lieutenant. You're still on the trail of those Apaches, aren't you?
That's right. And from the looks of things, you are too. You followed the tracks here, didn't you?
That's right. We've got business to take care of.
The kid glanced across the canyon's sandy floor. Valdez was hunkered on his heels next to one of the bodies. The kid frowned as he saw sunlight reflect off steel.
What's he doing?
Kelly glanced over his shoulder at Valdez.
That business I just mentioned.
Valdez straightened from the corpse with something dark hanging from his hand. He held it out toward Mateo.
Valdez just scalped that man, didn't he?
Oh, that's the only way to collect a bounty the Mexican government pays for dead Apaches. You've got to have the scalps to prove it. We made some money here today. Not a whole lot, mind you, but it all adds up.
You're scalp hunters.
Somebody's got to do it. It's no different from exterminating any other kind of vermin.
The kid was aware that Kelly was watching him. Though the man had seemed friendly enough so far, and had stopped Valdez from shooting at him, the kid saw something cold and intent in Kelly's eyes. A lot was riding on how he reacted.
Bounty, huh? Well, I killed four of those marmots, so I'll expect my share.
Oh, what'd I tell you, Chess? I told you that if we ran into Kid Morgan down here below the border, we ought to ask him to throw in with us.
You know who I am?
Well, I wasn't sure, but you said your name was Morgan, and I thought I remembered hearing about a fellow who's supposed to look like you. I know a man who's fast on the draw when I see one, and you're not anywhere near old enough to be that other Morgan, the one they call the Drifter. The
people will forget about him, but they'll remember me. Are you serious about wanting me to join forces with you?
Oh, damn right I'm serious. That's a damn big bunch of Redskins we're going after. We can use some help, especially from a man as good with a gun as you are.
Even with the ones we killed here, that war party still has 85 or 90 men in it. I'm not sure one more gun on your side is going to make much of a difference.
It would if we took them all at once. But my plan is to cut a few out of the bunch at a time. Also, I've got a pretty good idea where they're going. If we can get ahead of them, maybe we can set up an ambush on our own.
You know where their stronghold is?
Mateo's got a pretty good idea. But that's not where the Apaches will be going first. I knew that, as soon as you mentioned those female prisoners they have back in that border settlement.
I don't understand.
The Apaches won't be that interested in keeping the women. The fact that they haven't already killed them and dumped the bodies tells me they've got something else in mind for them. They're taking them to Alberto Guzman.
And who's that?
The biggest slaver in this part of Mexico.
Taking the scalps obviously had cheered him up, but Valdez still wasn't happy when he found out the kid was throwing in with them.
You can't trust this damn gringo.
Chess and I are gringos.
See, but that's different. This one kicked me in the cojones.
You drew a knife on him. He could have shot you.
Valdez turned to the kid.
I may have to work with you, gringo, but I don't have to like you.
Feelings mutual.
Now that we've got all that squared away, let's get moving. I don't want those savages to get too far ahead of us.
Valdez stored the scalps away in a canvas sack he hung on his saddle horn. From the ugly, faded brown stains on the sack, the kid could tell that it had been used for that purpose in the past, probably often. They led their horses up the ledge on the south wall of the canyon. Valdez and Mateo stayed behind to scalp the Apaches who still lay dead on the ledge at the site of the ambush.
They'll catch up to us. It won't take long for Lupe to lift those heathens' hair. He's had plenty of practice.
When they reached the top, the kid, Kelly, and Chess swung into their saddles and rode south, still following the war party's trail. Less than a quarter hour later, Valdez and Mateo galloped up from behind to join them. The sack bulged even more, and fresh bloodstains were soaking through the canvas.
Tell me more about this Guzman, hombre.
Sure. Like I told you, he deals in slaves. Indian, Mexican, white, it doesn't matter. As long as somebody's willing to pay, Guzman can supply the merchandise. Say you own a mine in the mountains, and you want some cheap labor to work it. Guzman can get you all the Indians you want. Once you've paid him, the only cost for that labor is a little bit of food. Damned little if you get my drift.
The mine owners work them and starve them to death.
Well, if there's one thing there's plenty of in this world, it's poor Indians. Or say you own a whorehouse, and some of your customers have a liking for young girls. Really young girls. Guzman's your man. He can find Mexican families who can spare an extra mouth or two that need to be fed. Or if he can't find any who are willing to sell their niñas, he can always just steal them.
The youngest of these captives I'm looking for is 17 or 18.
Aye, but they're white. There are rich men in Mexico City who will pay a pretty peso for white women they can do anything they want with. And Guzman has contacts with those men. He'll find somebody who's willing to pay his price for those gals once he's traded for them with the Apaches. You can count on that.
What's he going to trade for them?
Rifles, maybe. Ammunition, liquor, whatever the savages want. Guzman will get it.
You make it sound like he does all this out in the open.
Well, no, that's pretty much true. Most folks in northern Mexico know about Guzman.
Why haven't the Ruralis gone after him? I said something funny?
You just don't know. The reason the Ruralis haven't gone after Guzman is because Guzman is a Rurali. Captain of Ruralis, in fact. He's the commander in charge of his whole district.
The kid tried not to stare. He had known the Ruralis had a bad reputation, but he hadn't expected that an outright criminal was in charge of them in these parts.
So you think the Apaches are headed for Guzman's headquarters?
Oh, I'm sure of it.
Where's that?
The Ruralis barracks are in a village called San Remo, in the mountains southwest of here. Mateo thinks the Apache stronghold is in the same direction, only deeper in the mountains. They can stop and make their deal with Guzman on their way home.
That sounded reasonable and plausible to the kid. The scalp hunters stopped from time to time to rest their horses, but not for a meal. They gnawed pieces of jerky while they were in the saddle. Kelly shared some of his with the kid.
The least I can do, seeing as how you helped us out back there.
The trail continued south, even though Kelly had said it would angle toward the mountains when they got closer. In the middle of the afternoon, the five men came to a broad wash, veering to the southwest. Kelly reined in and pointed along it, even though the tracks of the war party continued almost due south.
That's the route we'll take. It's a shortcut to the foothills. With any luck, it'll put us ahead of the Apaches.
What if they don't go the way you think they're going to? We'll have to double back, and that'll just cost us time.
You don't know, Kelly. His plans are never wrong.
I appreciate that vote of confidence, Lupe. I'm not always right, but I've been tracking down those savages long enough that you can trust me on this, Morgan. They won't keep going south. There's nothing in that direction except badlands. But in the mountains, there are villages and farms and haciendas they can raid, along with Guzman's headquarters. That's where they're going, all right.
The kid realized he had no choice but to go along with Kelly's plan. Working with these men, no matter how repugnant he found them, still gave him his best chance of rescuing the prisoners.
Fine. You're the boss, Kelly.
Now that's what I like to hear. Come on.
It didn't take long for the kid to realize why the Apaches hadn't taken that route. The bottom of the wash was littered with rocks and gullies and clumps of brush. The riders had to weave around the obstacles, and it was slow going.
Are you sure this is going to save us some time?
Count on it. I know it's slow, but this way is 10 miles shorter. Also, we're deep enough into Mexico now that the Apaches won't be in any hurry at all.
And those bushwhackers they left behind don't come back. They may start to worry.
Not for another day or two.
Are we going to get where we're going before it gets dark?
No, but that's all right. We'll reach the foothills sometime tomorrow morning. And the savages probably won't get there until the middle of the day. Maybe later.
All the kid could do was hope that Kelly was right.